So yesterday we Friday, excuse me, Kevin and Bob and myself traveled to Berkeley for the Presbytery meeting, the spring 2016 Presbytery meeting. So we're going to give a report, overview, discussion of what went on. A bit disjointed, I would tell you, probably, well, for me for sure, because we got back really late, or later than we expected. So I think we had a grand plan or to do something a little different. So bear with us, bear with me. And my clicker is out of batteries. So, oh my goodness, you can't see that. That's a really dark picture of the presbytery. Krista, can you come help me? I'm going to run out of battery up here. Get into the power, please. Oops. So that was supposed to be a picture of where the presbytery is, and the reason I put that one up there, Kevin took that for me. I remember when I didn't know what presbytery was the first time I expected, and I don't know what my expectations were or why they were, but it's a church. We were in the Berkeley Church, probably about half the size of this room. It's a smaller sanctuary. And then I went up after I finished my work for the day. So when I got there, and this is kind of what happens at each, there's some meeting things that go on, and then there'll be a break, and they call it the order of the day. And I learned that usually means a good thing because it means a break's coming, either lunch or a break or something. So, and what'll happen is they'll come up to whatever time that is, and someone, the moderator's really busy. He's trying to facilitate and keep all these things going. So a lot of times it's somebody in the crowd that says, "Mr. Moderator, order of the day." And what that means in my translation is we need a break, or we're at the time that's assigned for the break. So then you go out for break, and you some people just hang around, and a lot of people are discussing what went on or discussing what's coming up. And then when you come back, they sing. And I'm going to play this for you. I've not done this before, so I'm going to play it. Eric, get ready to help me with audio because I'm going to play a song on my phone through the microphone. That makes sense. Here we go. Okay, so each break they come back. Thoughts on that? What'd you hear? What'd you feel? What'd you sense? Comments. I had lots of things running through my head as this group sang. Anybody want to share any thoughts or?
Someone was flat.
Someone was flat. It was probably me. Most likely it was me because I was closest to the microphone. It's probably more than one person. What else? For somebody that wasn't there. No comments on singing? They were singing heartily. It was loud. Yeah? What else did you hear? And I'm not only looking for positive comments, if that helps.
It sounds like
everybody participated.
Yeah.
I was bothered by a part of it. And then thankful for something else in the next breath. It was a bunch of men singing. There weren't. And what dawned on me as we were singing is women singing in the church and men too. It's by God's design, is we sound different. And it sounds beautiful to me when it's together. When it's separate, I'm hopeful to God that it was beautiful to him to hear that joyful sound we were making. But in my human ear, it didn't sound as good as singing sounds when it's male and female voices both. And I was thankful for the singing, and I'm glad we do that there, and that's part of the protocol is that when you come back from a break, there's a hymn each time. The other thing it does, just from a facilitation of a meeting standpoint, is there's lots of, like I said, discussions maybe going on outside, And they'll tell, we're starting in 2 minutes. We're starting in a minute. Okay, we're starting. And there's still people straggling around. And so the song is a way to say, sit down now. Does that sound familiar to anyone? Do we do that here? We do. The piano starts. Typically, we try to do it 5 minutes before. And that's a cue to all of us to say, here we go. We need to sit down. So it's a similar type of thing. That's just how the structure of the meeting functions. So came in, sang. We might go back in time if Kevin chooses to, because I wasn't there from noon. Is that what started at noon on Friday? Okay. Okay, afternoon, and I got there about 6:30 or 7, I think. So if there's things that we need to discuss that I wasn't there for, he'll bring that up later. But when I got there, the first thing, I'm just going to take you through chronology and then maybe give some color commentary to what went on. So when I first got there, yikes, sorry. There was a motion being made. Not about customer service, it's the wrong page. All right. There was a motion being made for a committee to be established by the moderator, and it had to do with some charges that were being filed. And we'll come back to this possibly later on, because this issue is what we spent the lion's share of the time that we were on debating. Didn't really come to any conclusions finally, but had lots and lots and lots of discussion about it. So what the start of this meeting was a committee was established to investigate what we were potentially going to talk about later in the meeting. So what this committee's job was, while the meeting's going on, is to investigate the situation. So these guys had a lot on their plate because we're participating in a meeting. And then, like I said, on breaks, we're maybe taking it easier, enjoying company of one another and having discussions. This committee's job was at the end of presbytery, Lord willing, to give a report out. So that's the first thing that happened. Then we had a gentleman from the RCUS, Reformed Church of the United States. All right. I liked his name. His name was Mr. Merica, M-E-R-C-A. And he came and he talked. What's the word? What's he?
Just gave a report.
But he's a fraternal.
Fraternal delegate.
Fraternal delegate from the RCUS. So it's a church that's Reformed, similar theology and doctrine to ours. And so he came and gave a report. And the report he gave centered around the definition of marriage and some of the changes they've made to their actual constitution. And this has been in the news. This specific church has been in the news recently for the stance that they've taken on marriage. What was interesting is up there, I got to spend some time with some people from the San Francisco church. Anybody know what the San Francisco church became notorious or maybe famous for back in the 80s? What was it, Claire? Yeah, they had an organist that they hired, and then they discovered that he was practicing homosexual. They confronted him, the pastor did, Chuck McElhaney, right? Chuck McElhaney confronted him, Matthew 18, followed that process. He chose not to change his behavior. He was terminated, sued, and then in part of that, and by the way, he sued the church, he sued the McElhaney family, he sued the presbytery. All of these folks were named in this lawsuit. It wasn't just one group. There's a book about it if you want to read it. It's called When the Wicked Sees the City. What happened after that was a lot of terrible things to his family. Children were threatened by these folks, and they named his children by name, described them, told them where he went to school, told them what they were going to do to them before they killed them. Firebombed the McElhaney's house / church. The church is right next to their house. There was two gasoline bombs were lit. The fire inspector's comment was, this was intended to kill. And Mr. McElhaney will tell you by God's grace that they survived this. And this was because he was being faithful in upholding the word of God. So as this guy was talking, Mr. Merica, that was clicking in my head because I'd spent some time with these people from the San Francisco church. We hadn't talked about the issue that they'd had, but it was just fresh in my mind. One of the things that potentially can happen when we stand up and preach the whole counsel of God, which our pastor faithfully does. He doesn't skirt around certain things. He takes them head on. And one of the things we can be praying for as a church is for our pastor to be faithful to do that. And if you hear the elders, we try to pray regularly to be faithful to the word. Part of that is a fidelity to the word is not sidestepping stuff. I don't want to upset somebody. I don't want to offend somebody. I want it to be happy. I want it to be a loving church. But if we don't confront sin as a church, it will continue like a cancer to eat into our church. So I'm thankful for our pastor that he does that. And we can pray for him to continue to do that. And two, pray that that God guards his church, hedges us about, protects us from evil. So I was thankful for Mr. America standing up and speaking about this, because the other thing it did for me is it helped me understand we're not alone. Sometimes when you're the minority in a thought process, which we probably often are, if you speak up about your faith in the world, you're usually the minority. I am anyways. And it's comforting to me to know that there's other people out there that think like I do and believe like I do. And just the human side of me, it's sinful, but I'm comforted by that, but I do think it's a grace of God. So he spoke. Then we talked about bylaws, state budget. I'm not sure what this means. Oh, okay. So we talked about a change to the budget. And what was said was the bylaws state, this is of the presbytery, that the budget is done in the fall stated meeting. So to me, that means we do the budget in the fall stated meeting. And I'm going to use some work terminology. That's what we do. We do the same thing in my work. And once we set that budget, guess what we use for the year? That budget. That's what we use. Because it's a budget. And it guides you and directs you how you're going to handle your organization financially. So one of the things that was said was this, the budget is done at the fall stated meeting, which would have been in September of 2015. But the bylaws make no mention about amendments. So in the spring meeting, we can adjust the budget. I don't understand the form of government like a parliamentarian. I don't have a great grasp of that, but that troubled me. That because it doesn't say you can't make an amendment, you can make an amendment. And what I learned was, in our Presbyterian government, I should have said this at the start, this is a learning process. I'm liking it. I'm soaking it up. I'm tempted to the sin of frustration because we take a long time to do things that I think should be done faster. And I'm reminded of God's timing. I'm going to do my notes at the top. And I need patience. Pray for me for patience. That's what I would ask you to do. So back to this. What I learned about our form of government is certain things that we vote on require a majority. And so how that works is he'll say, I'm going to put the question to the floor. I'm making this up. Do we think Taco Bell is a great restaurant? All in favor, stand up. And those people stand up. Take that back. Let me back up. That doesn't happen first. First, he says, do we think Taco Bell is a great restaurant? All in favor, say aye. And those people, the two people, probably would say aye. And who opposed, say no. And they say no. And he says, motion denied. Taco Bell's not a great restaurant. What happened often in this meeting was he would say that. Who thinks it's a great place? Aye. Who thinks it's not? Aye. And to me, it sounded really even. And I thought, ooh, this is going to be interesting. How do they do this? And what happens is someone in the moderator makes a decision at that point who he heard more of. And he'll say, the motion's denied. Or the motion's carried. And so in this Taco Bell instance, we'll pretend that I'm voting that Taco Bell's great. And I said, aye. And the nay said, nay. And he said, motion denied, Taco Bell is not great. At that point, I can say, division. And that's somebody shouts it out. Division. What that means, I learned, is count them up. I'm going to say my words. I don't know, moderator, if you heard the applause meter right. It sounded like we need to count it. So let's go to a specific count. So at that point, he says, all the ayes stand up. And the individuals stand up and then he head counts. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, including himself, right? He gets the vote too, moderator. So he counts himself too, which side he votes on. And then the next group stands up. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I was talking to Bob on the way home. A lot of respect I have already and gained for a moderator. It's a tough group to herd together, first of all. There's a lot going on. He has a lot of people picking at him. And it reminds me of somebody, if you've ever seen somebody that's a wedding coordinator, how many people are after them for stuff? It's a difficult job because everybody wants the thing to go just right. And this person has a lot of things coming at him. On top of it, he has to count these people accurately, including himself. The reason I remember that is one time he forgot himself in terms of counting. So anyways, so this vote is held, and then after he does the head count, he declares it based on those number of people to be passed or denied. In certain cases, in our form of government, you need a majority. That's most. So more than not. More yeses than noes, more noes than yeses, that carries. In certain cases, not this budget one, you require what's a supermajority, and that number changes depending on the issue. So in most cases, 50% is the required, over 50%, I should say 51%, is the required number to pass or deny a motion. In other cases, it's a different percentage. And it reminded me a lot of civics class, government class, learning about how our government works in the United States, that there's different numbers, percentages that are required to pass or deny different legislation. So that happened. There you go. Then the next morning, I'm skipping a few things. You want to jump in anything on day one? Okay. Next morning, we had a devotion from Terry Tolley? Toll? Tolley. I heard it Toll and Tolley. It's Tolley. Tolley. Terry Tolley gave the devotion. He is a retired pastor that is serving in the Madeira mission work. Correct me on my terminology here. It's a church that's in Madeira that actually our pastor serves, augments their session, as well as some other folks that they don't have a large enough group, so they don't have official elders. So other elders from other churches will come and serve that function of leadership. So our pastor does that for them. So he gave this devotion, and it was on John 21:15-18, which is the part of Scripture where Christ asks Peter, "Do you love me?" And what does Peter say? From anybody remember what he says? He says, "Yes." He's a little stronger than that, doesn't he? "Of course I love you." And then what does Christ ask him next? "Do you love me?" Well, yeah, then he gives him a command. Thank you, Bill. He gives him a command. Then he asks him the same question again. "Peter, do you love me?" And then what he's asking him the third time? "Do you love me?" Same question. He asks him that thing, the same question three times. So that was the passage that he talked about. What was interesting was what he talked about was a couple of quotes from his message. Peter had a history of failing. Peter had a history of sin. Peter had a history of pride. Peter had a history of arrogance. Peter had a history of self-confidence. And I listened to that, and I nodded my head and agreed. And then he talked about us as leaders and individuals. He talked specifically to pastors in certain areas, and then other times leaders, and then other times the girl group. He said, we as people have a history of failing. Anybody disagree that you have a history of failing? Anybody have a history of sin? History of pride? History of arrogance? History of self-confidence? Sinfully so? And then he talked about what Christ asked of Peter. And he asked it three times. And what did he ask? "Do you love me?" He asked Peter for love. That's what he asked him for. And his comment was, there's no life where there is no love. And then he quoted somebody. I didn't get it down. And he said that, he said, it's not that Christ doesn't ask, did you do this or that? Did you carry these things out? Did you not do this and not do that? He asks him, "Do you love me? Do you love me? Do you love me?" And Mr. Tolley talked about that if you don't, he quoted somebody and said, if you don't have love, you are like a painted wax figure in a museum, which you look like maybe a Christian, or you look like a believer, or you look the part, but you're made out of wax. You're not alive. You're a painted wax finger, a stuffed beast in a museum, a clanging cymbal or tinkling brass, which comes from the Scripture. And it was a powerful message. It was a short, maybe half hour, 45 minutes, but very powerful. And then he closed it with, It's the love of Christ that will give you a love for his sheep. And remember, he's talking to pastors mainly, and then to leaders of the church. And what he talked about is not, sheep are not always lovable. There's the one that strays, and the one that doesn't listen, the one that doesn't obey. But the love of Christ gives us love for one another, whether we're a pastor or an elder or a believer. And what he talked about was, remember how Christ forgave me. He started making it personal, this application. He says, I remember how Christ forgave me, and then forgave me again, and then forgave me again, and forgave me again. Think about yourself. How often do you sin? How often do you are you forgiven when you ask? And if you're me, you sin a lot, all day, every day. Thought, word, and deed. A lot of thoughts, a lot of negativity, a lot of sin going on in my little head. And I'm forgiven again and again and again. That's a grace of God, and it's a mercy of God. Yet, I'll tell you, for me, the first thing I don't think when somebody sins against me again, the same wound again in the same place, the first thing I don't think is, well, I need to forgive them again because I've been forgiven and I don't deserve that forgiveness. So that's, it doesn't jump into my mind. I'm praying that it does, that I can be quick to forgive. I'm quick to remember that wrong. This is the fourth time you did this to me. Mr. Goddard used to say this when I worked for him, and it's a business-ism, but he would say, I'll take new wounds all day long. And what that means is when you're starting a business, you're going to make mistakes, and you don't want people not to try. So what you're telling them is you're going to fail, and it's okay. Actually, I want you to fail. Because if you fail, you're going to learn. And so I'll take a new failing all day long. And he was faithful as a leader to let us know we failed, but encourage us to say, get up, go again, new wounds. But he would tell me, don't hit me in scar tissue. Don't hit me in the same place again. And that resonated with me, and it still does. And I thought of that as I heard this message, that I'm sinful. And my boss was sinful in saying that, in a way. Picking on you a little bit. Think you can take it. Christ isn't like that, thankfully. Christ doesn't say, hey, Ben, you sinned this sin yesterday already. This is the 15th time this week you've sinned this sin. I'm not forgiving you this time. I've had it. I'm up to here with you. He doesn't do that, thankfully. Again and again and again and again and again. And Terry said it, I think, 15 times, which was great. It was for effect. It was powerful. My summary of this, it was convicting and encouraging to me at the same time, which when I hear a powerful message, when I thank our pastor, which you should do after he preaches a sermon, thank him for that. When I do, it's typically because it was both of those things. Because I was convicted of my sin and my failing and how terrible I am and how I fail our righteous Savior. But in the next moment, the gospel's in there. And it says, Ben, you messed up and you are a sinner, but Christ is ready to forgive you again and again and again and again. So, all right. So then we had the credentials committee came up. The credential committee in general, Ben's words, is the one that figures out who's potentially going to be a pastor and how we're going to deal with them, how we're going to bring them along, train them, teach them, get them ready to become a pastor. It's a lot more formal than that, but this committee is the oversight of bringing new pastoral blood, if you will, into the presbytery, this presbytery. So this committee talked about, gave reports on four or five young men, I don't know how young they are, that are in some process of wanting to become a minister or on their way in terms of that, going to school, just saying they want to are interested in it and exploring it. And then what they do is they will make recommendations at a certain point that person X be taken under the care of the presbytery or be taken under the care of X church. And what that means is they're assigning them or linking them up with someone to do mentoring and work with them on becoming a pastor. And they'll even preach at a church that they're attached to, and it's to give them tools and training to eventually become a pastor full time. So they talked about several of these gentlemen. Two of them were there. Ben Ortiz is one, and Adrian Espinosa. Adrian Espinosa got up and gave his testimony, and he had a rough life. He, Turlock, Ceres area, Modesto, he's a Norteño, or was, a recovering Norteño. He's a gang member up there. Got into a lot of that gang life, and then got into the army, got married, went to church, was converted. His wife was converted shortly thereafter, and I'm shortening the story. And then he feels a call to go into to the ministry. After they give their testimony, they can be asked questions about anything. And someone asked him a question. I can't remember what the first question was, and he answered it. And it was an okay answer. The second question he was asked was a tough question. It was a theological question. And it was chewy. And it was Reformed at the heart of it. And he didn't know the answer. And I talked to him after about this answer. So if you're in a position like that, and think about this, I'm going to describe a little bit. It's this group of all these super smart eldery pastory people, right, that know theology, and they got their Bibles down, right? They understand these things. And you're asked this question that's pretty chewy, and you don't know the answer. Tim, what would you say in that situation? What would you be tempted to say? That's an awesome answer. I was thinking I probably wouldn't have said that. I probably would have went, well, what you got is, you know, there's lots of ways to run at that. And, you know, I'll put it to you this way. Okay, so say if you, I have two cousins. And I would probably do something like that, which isn't righteous. And this kid, I'll call him a kid, he's very young, gave a righteous answer. He said, I don't know the answer to that, and I don't want to answer out of ignorance, so I'm just going to say I don't know the answer to that. And to me, that's a leader, someone that has the humility to say, I don't know. And I'll bet you he's studying that subject probably today, or went back that night and probably talked to his pastor, his mentor, and said, hey, help me out with this gap. I need to learn about this area because I'm weak here. I struggle here. I was reminded of when I was candidating for an elder, and I was asked a very tough question in the part of the process. And I know why I think I would answer the way I answer, because that's how I answered it in that moment. Thankfully, by God's grace, I went back and studied that area because I was weak on it. But I was thankful for the question, both, and for the answer. So that was a powerful moment for me. The next section was, there's an attendance thing that goes around. It's like a big notebook and has every church listed. It's real small font, and it has these lines. And up on the lines at the top, each one, there's each church, Hanford Church, the Sonora Church, the Modesto Church. And there's this line for the pastor to sign. I was here. And then there's this other line that has two lines on it, and it says F and S. And each church has F, S, F, S, F, S. I don't know all the terminology, so I was sitting there, I was thinking, is that fraternal? I heard the word fraternal delegate. Is that fraternal? And is that secondary, fidel, faithful, F, S, S? So I asked several people, what does F and S mean? And one gentleman said, oh, I don't know, I should know. And I asked another gentleman, he said, And so I was sitting behind Eric Erickson, who is 90, Bob? Is he pushing 90? No? 80? Okay. Almost 80. He's been in the presbytery for a long time. So I leaned over and I tapped him and I said, what does F and S stand for on these sign-in things? Anybody that wasn't there and that hasn't been there, want to guess at what F and S stands for? That's a good guess. It's not fat and stout. It's not factual and sensible. This was some of the things that people told me they thought it meant. It stands for, this is complex, so I'm just going to tell you, I think you guys can handle it. It stands for Friday and Saturday. So I felt kind of silly. Not kind of, I felt really silly. Friday and Saturday is what you're signing is, I was here on Friday And I had to run back up to the front and sign Saturday because I was there both days. But as I said up front, I'm learning still some of this stuff. All right, that's FNS. Morgan Hill, dollars, nonprofit to nonprofit. I'm not going into that, I don't think. Well, sure. So Morgan Hill was a attempt to start a church in Morgan Hill. And there was money spent, and there was time spent and energy and effort by an oversight session. It's a similar kind of deal where the session acts as their session until this work gets started. And it was because there was a group of families that formerly were in the San Jose church, I think, and then they moved, or it was a long way for them to drive. They were already there. That's what it was. They were already there, long way to drive. Hey, can we have a church closer to home? Can we start up a church? We've got X amount of families. Let's give this a go. It did not work. They hope that it'll be resurrected at some point, but they're done. They've called it on this work. But there's money associated that people had given, and so now the question is, what do you do with that money? And so there's a lot of discussion about how to do that. It's nonprofit to nonprofit dollars, so there's some tax implications and other things. So we talked about that for a while. The motion was that we let this money sit until 2021, which is roughly 5 years, in the hopes that Morgan Hill gets rolling again. There was a counter motion that we wait only 3 years, I think, 2018, is that what it was? 2018, 2021, that was the new motion. Oh, the other one was 2025.
The original motion was 2021.
2021, and then it was adjusted to 2018?
We tried.
Yeah, attempted. Yeah. That was our pastor that valiantly tried. And I think at that moment it was at the fourth vote, and I leaned over and I said, I haven't won one of these votes yet.
Right.
And I hadn't. So that went on. And then, remember, this is day two. This is on Saturday. And it was also at this moment, after I talked to him about voting, as I said, hey, we're on item two. Or he said to me, I think, hey, we're on item B, and we got to go through G, and it's already 11 a.m. We're not going to finish, are we? And he said, nope, we're not. Or we're gonna be here late. I think that's what our comment was. We're gonna be here a lot longer than we thought. So we knew at that point this was gonna extend on. The next discussion had to do with the Treasury report, and it's he gives a finance overview. He's the treasurer of the presbytery. And just kind of like in our congregational meeting, he goes through a balance sheet and it's not P&L. Can't say P&L on a nonprofit. I can't remember what the word is. Balance sheet? It's just balance sheet. Okay, balance sheet. It's a balance sheet. To me, it looks like a profit and loss statement, but because it's...
Statement of cash flow.
That's what I was looking for. We look through the statement of cash flow as well as the balance sheet. And it talks about what it really in general is how much did we receive as a presbytery, how much did we give out, and how much do we have left. It's really what it is. It's an accounting of the financial picture of the church. And then there was a motion to encourage the churches to give a certain amount to the presbytery. It was the first motion where I just scratched my head because the motion was we move that the presbytery instruct the churches. You got it? Thank you. The scribbled out one? Which one am I looking for? That one. Thank you. The committee with oversight of revolving funds, let me back up. We move that the committee with oversight of revolving funds be mindful to scrutinize the balances and activity of the funds and provide guidance to Presbytery through her finance committee and treasurer, as well as their own committee reports. A lot of stuff in there. The verb is be mindful. And as I think through when we make a motion, some action, there's command, how do you enforce be mindful? If I tell you, be mindful, how do I come back and deal with that? And that was brought up. There were several people, I think our pastor being one, that raised a question and said, Mr. Lemon was another one, raised his hand and said, I don't understand why we're moving to do this. In essence, what they were just saying is, if the church is going to continue in a deficit, the presbytery, in a deficit spending, meaning bringing in less than you're putting out, this can't continue forever, right? I'm reminded of a church that I went to when I was a kid that had a lot of money, and they spent a lot of money, and they had a gym, and they had a roller skating thing, and it was really neat. There's a lot of cool stuff going on there. And there's a lot of giving going on. And then I went to other churches where there wasn't all that neat stuff because there wasn't as much giving. And then people started giving and giving, and this church ended up with a lot of money. And relatively a lot of money. And there was discussion about what to do with it. When I first came to this church, that's some discussions I had as well. And just this was reinforced with me, is the church, and I struggle with this, the church is not a business, and it's not a household. So if you think about what you do in your household, you're saving money. We're taught to save money. What are you saving for? What do you save for? Your future, right? If you're a kid, you're saving for a bike. Tim's pointing at Kaylin. He's saving for her. You're saving for your future, whatever that is. That's college, retirement, I want to get a cabin on the lake, all those kind of things. And there's usually some sort of goal. I need X amount of money to retire comfortably how I want to live. And then if you look at a business, the business is to perpetuate the business and to continue to generate revenue, hopefully a profit, on top of that. Church doesn't function like this. And I'm not advocating what I'm going to say, but I think it is the mindset. The church should run out of money at the end of every month. It's not a good way to plan, and we're not going to function like that. But theoretically, think about it. What is the money for? It's for the work of the church. And then we're to trust on faith that we'll get taken care of. But we're not going to go to our pastor and say, boy, I hope I can pay you next month. We'll talk about it on the 30th. You know, we'll see if we can do that. That's not righteous to do that either. So that's why I said it's a theoretical. So whenever I hear things about money being talked about in church, I pray to be mindful of that. What is the purpose of what we're doing here with this money? If it's going for something and there is a goal, hey, we're going to buy this or we're going to do this, or we have this ministry coming up and we need X amount of dollars. I get that. But if you're just saving money and putting it in CDs and investing and doing this, those are all interesting things, but why? And that's what my challenge to folks would be, is why are you doing that? All right, Treasury Report. Mark Bube. We're going to run out of time. We may continue this next week. Mark Bube, thank you. Chairman of the Foreign Missions Committee. So he's, my words, the guy that oversees all the missionaries that are in other countries. So he talked a lot of energy. I was digging on this guy. He came with a lot of passion. He is in the right role. He is a fit for what he does. He was exciting. He was interesting to listen to. He was credible. He knew what he was talking about. So he gave a handout. I have a slide up there. You won't be able to see it. We have them. We'll make copies if you're interested. It clicked through each of the areas that we have a foreign missionary, and then it gave just a little short, brief statement about them. And the purpose for this is put it on your refrigerator, put it wherever you're going to remember it, and pray for these folks. So he went through each one of them. He's from Philadelphia. He says, huge. This is a huge problem we have. He talked about Eritrea. Our missionary was arrested and then kicked out, or kicked out and arrested, or both. I couldn't get straight what happened. Can't go back there under threat of arrest. And his comment was interesting. He said, we can get them back in on a tourist visa. There's a way to get them in. And the government can't do anything about that. But what the government will do if we do that is they will attack the Christians, not them. They won't go after these missionaries, which they used to do. They'll make the Christians' lives miserable. So think about if that's your role as the foreign missions person, that's a tough thing to do, to put people out in the field knowing you're bringing persecution on a group of Christians. Talk about Ethiopia. Ethiopia is growing from a small African village that it used to be into a metropolis. They're putting in a light rail. They've built a beltway. Beltway is a freeway, if you will, that runs in a circle around a city. Memphis has one, hopefully well. When it says west, you might be heading north or east. Growing city, and what the laws are, why this means something to us, is inside that beltway, no one story, no buildings, one story. The smallest building you can build inside the beltway is two stories. Two, no tents inside the beltway. You can't set up a tent. Guess where the churches meet? In tents or in one-story buildings. So what this does is it means you either violate the law or you go outside the beltway to have church. You can find a different building if you can get one. But if you think about a city that's growing there, and if they run anything like our cities do, churches don't really help your city in terms of finances. because you don't have the same, you can't generate the same revenue for the city that you can if a business or a residence is in that on that property. There's no tax base. You don't generate that for yourself. So this church has moved 7 times in the last year, he said. So be thankful if you're prone to complain about not having our own building, and we don't have a church where we, or a kitchen where we can have nice things, and we're in the SDA building, we have to do this, and we have to get our hymn books out every morning. We could be in a tent under a tree moving 7 times. So we're blessed. We're blessed. Confession. I'm going to close with this because we're out of time, and then we'll pick up next week, Lord willing, with the other things. This is a confession from Mark Bube, who's the foreign mission director of foreign missions. He said when he first went to Ethiopia, there was this group of people that were there, and they were meeting under this tree, and they're having church. And he was struck by how bitter these people were, and he said they it was the personification of evil. He'd never had such a sense of bitterness and the spirit of the evil one, is what he said, in a group of people. It was profound to him as he was watching this go on. And these are the people that they're trying to get into the church and convert and go through this. He went back 10 years later, and he was taking pictures, and this is recently, and he was taking pictures and not thinking about this previous time. He was just taking pictures to put in the newsletter because that's his job, because he's got to help, you know, generate some funds to keep this work, mission work going. And he said he was struck by all of the people smiling. And that was a difference. He had gone before and he didn't see a smile. And then this time he comes and he sees smiles. And his comment was, God smashes, hardens hearts with his love. We have these hearts of stone that are brittle, and God smashes them with his love. Think back to the message from Terry Tolley. Tolley? Same message. They didn't get together. They didn't say, okay, what do we want to talk about? We're going to talk, let's make the theme love. Let's make this and let's bookend it. Yes, Bill. That was Ethiopia. But it kind of bookended it on both sides. Confession from me on the way home. I was talking to Bob about this, and I was convicted myself, and I was convicted for our presbytery and maybe for our church. Do we smile a lot? Do we show the joy of the Lord? Or if somebody walked in here and took pictures, would they go away with that same impression that Mr. Bube had? I can tell you, at presbytery, the first time I went away with that impression. This one was better. Thank you for introducing me to a lot of people. He was very gracious, said, this is Ben. But I would tell you, walking into that group, it's not a smiley, happy group. There's not a lot of joy going on. Jeff, you're laughing. Would you agree in your history? Right. That's terrible. It's sin is what it is. We should show the joy of the Lord. The first thing we should do is be smiling and have that energy. Why did Mark Bube stand out so much? Because I can tell you, most of the speakers that were up there were talking about this, and they were talking about this, and he got up there, and he was walking and moving and talking, and he had the joy of the Lord in his heart. You could see it. It wanted to come out. It was coming out. So back to his closing phrase, and then we'll pray. Something to think about. God can. He's powerful. He's sovereign. He can smash the hardened hearts with love. So if you think about your loved ones, this is what I thought about, that aren't saved. Most of them probably have a hard heart. I know mine do. I've talked to them about the gospel. They know. They know all the stuff. They choose not to do it because their heart is hard. And I'm tempted to sin to say, lost cause. He's never going to believe. He's too much of a rebel, too much of a mess. He's lived too much of a bad life. He's had too many bad things happen to him that he chalks up to God doing that to him. He's running from God, all these things. There's nothing that can be done. But that's not true, is it? Why not? Because God smashes that hardened heart. He's that powerful to be able to crush that heart with love. And so to me, the convicting thing is, what do I need to do to those relatives and those loved ones? Show them love. Show them love. Be kind to them. And show them the joy of the Lord, not the somber, let me hammer you with the Bible and thump you on this stuff. Show them the love of God. You want to close this? I'll pray. You want me to pray? I'll pray. Let's pray. We're over time. Heavenly Father, we